Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 3 of The Accidental Quantum Physicist, which is me. And I'll just go on. I'm sort of punching out these episodes, sort of sitting down one day, aiming for 20 minutes each. They're going for about 40 minutes. Now, the first episode was sort of just an introduction to the accident of you listening to this crazy podcast, me making these crazy podcasts, and the crazy sorts of situations which led in a funny sort of way to discovery, quantum discovery. And my sort of quantum discovery was in a physics tea room with computer printouts of the quantum wave functions. You know, nowadays you've got computer screen printouts, and just working through and trying to fix it all together. I suppose having some experience trying to use some quantum mechanics and getting to an idea of what it looks like. Episode 2 went on to delve a bit deeper into what a quantum thing is. So this quantum phenomenology, which is mind-bending, especially if it's badly explained and you've got bad maths. There's something they don't really tell you, that the basis of what they're showing you is not really quantum mechanical. There's the old picture of the tiny electron, the big electron, and the big nucleus. It's the opposite way around. And a lot of the stuff is based on complete rubbish. However, sort of learning enough to know that I really have to boot you up with what it's actually like. And this is four principles I think I came up with. And I suppose I came up with four principles because Einstein had two postulates, Bohr had three postulates, which, not really all that sensible. And then the Einstein's ones were sensible, they were drop postulates. Bohr had three postulates. Bohr's the person behind the Simpsons atom, the atom with the little electrons going around in circles around the little clump of cluster of like sweets. You could almost eat them. It's an almost edible atom. And of course, if they're the gobstopper atom, I've got the fairy floss atom. And the fairy floss atom, we said before, had four components. I'll just stop after doing these four components. A, if something's lighter, it's actually bigger. There's no surfaces. These things with no surfaces and are big can actually be twisted. A little caveat that they can be, or a little side thing, they're twisted by light. And that they stack through each other in space like ghosts. And, I suppose I'll start off this story about a bit of a journey through the past and living with falsehood, going across. So as I've understood this and then proceeded on to use more quantum physics, more laser physics, you sort of start to get sort of used to using a bit more maths in it, and you start to see how the maths actually relates to real things. So that's my journey. No one taught me. I suppose I am very self-taught in year. When I was the year before my final year, we were going overseas in my year 10. It was just 2 years earlier. And we went overseas for a year, 1980. I graduated in 1982, so I'm an old fart. But, you might complain about me. You are in the spell of really old people. They've all retired and they've left their rubbish behind for you, and they're still teaching. However, I thought I'm going to fail at chemistry and stuff like that. So I thought, what I'll do is I'll study chemistry on my own. And so I sort of self-taught myself the old-school quantum mechanics to myself. And then the chemistry I had to learn when I got into year 11, year 12, which is the second and last year of school, was just completely outdated. It was sort of a bit mind-bending, but I sort of really pushed myself, and they had the, oh, I don't the abortive quantum mechanics, which is sort of quantum mechanics propped up by classical thinking. And so, yeah, so there's that stuff. So I've gone on and teaching, you students will say something quite insightful, which will be right, and you're torn because the school system says they're wrong, and if they say it'll be wrong in the exam, but you try. And so it sort of pushes you around the place a bit like that. And so there's been many years where I've sort of lived with people being wrong. I sort of just get used to it. They're wrong, say, particularly about the ozone layer, environmental issues. You know, just blatantly wrong. There's someone who said that the water going out of a hydroelectric dam heats up. Going down, it must heat up. How else does it drive a generator? And you say, oh, I'm not going to correct that. I'll just leave that as it goes, because you know, it's part of the atmosphere. You don't want to always be correcting people. And there was a similar system. I was really, really great friends with a Professor Ross at ANU, Ian Ross at ANU. Just great. We just bumped into each other and just really got along. And we sort of started off in the same page. He was a molecular physicist, I was a molecular physicist. And he was just a wonderful old guy who's the vice chancellor, about to retire. He had a painting which moved and revealed a beer, not a beer, a whiskey. He's a whiskey smoke, lovely old man. He would talk to me a bit about molecular physics and Hertzberg and all these types of people. And Hertzberg and molecular physics was really sort of the heyday, the extension of the old way of thinking. And so if I had discovered this new stuff, or not discovered new stuff, you know, learnt the new stuff, and I decided that, he was a valuable friend, I wasn't going to muddy it up with this knowledge. And eventually looked after him, he died, I went to his wake, and I thought, well, at the funeral, I'll say, well, guys, it's about time we went into quantum physics. And to my shock, everyone just hadn't made the transitions themselves. I just was sort of just a bit dumbfounded, but just went along my life in general. So there's this sort of understanding of this old way of thinking. Now, if I can get, you know, sort of set you up, there's a character I'm going to tell you about called Niels Bohr, a Danish person, of a Jewish banking father, a family. He's called the father of the modern atom. Well, I would say the father of the vintage atom in my book. And he's in Denmark before World War II. So you've got the world brewing with Nazism and all this amazing stuff. I suppose it is amazing. It's not amazing great. It's amazing wow. What was that all about? What was Europe all about then? And it all stems from this chap Bohr. He's a very big person, big powerful person. In fact, indeed, his real calling in life was as a football player. We'll go back to it now. And I wouldn't say he was dumb, but I don't think he was in the same sort of universe as the other scientists or a modern scientist. And I think I had various aspects of what a scientist is, sort of skeptical, open-minded, naive, optimistic, all these types of things, self-doubt. I don't think he had a lot of self-doubt. You've got all these complex things which go up to make a modern scientist. But just before we go too far, the word scientist came when there's Whewell of 1836 was being hassled by someone to come up with a name for what this sort of person who wasn't rich, he wasn't from a family, he wasn't self-funded, but he's doing good for society. What do you call him? And what's it called? It's the poet was called I've forgotten the name of the poet, but they're having a conversation, and he, in writing a review, coined the word scientist, because the German word wasn't, we know how long German words are, that just was a long German word, so he coined it up, and scientists got a lot of values into it, plugged into it from Victorian. It was a Victorian invention, what a scientist is, and, and a lot of this, a lot of Victorian male ideas packed into a scientist, which really don't translate into a modern era of an intensely sensitive, doubting type of person. But getting back, so we've got Bohr in Denmark, and so just to put you, there's Germany has sort of like this, Europe's got the boot of Italy underneath it, above the Alps, then Germany, flat, beautiful Rhineland, all the beer swilling, sort of Munich type of, little clock, villages and all the wonderful sound of music stuff, the Alps, and go up a bit of swampy land around Hamburg, and then it goes up into a little peninsula, and then there's, if you don't watch it, if you don't pay attention, Denmark is actually mostly an island. There's a peninsula there, which is, it's good for trading, getting down to Europe, but Copenhagen, most of it's an island, and then in the sort of mouth of the Baltic Sea going in, that's Copenhagen, wonderful Copenhagen. I can't help but think of Danny Kaye and all that other stuff. So he's in that site. It's going to be a little bit of a story, so it's worthwhile doing. We're sort of leaving quantum mechanics behind because these people have never walked the walk or talked the talk of quantum mechanics. Now, as I've said, sort of the idea of a scientist is a Victorian fiction. I think there is a modern idea of a technology strategist, computer literate strategist would be sort of what I would say, a humanist and a strategist, what I say more a scientist now. But back then it went through, and in the early 19th centuries of the 18th, you've got all these people coming around, all these theories, and everything's up for grabs. So you got philosophers and church people talking about, it's a really exciting time still. The post-enlightenment, late enlightenment, Charles Darwin, stuff like that. But there are these really what you would call amateur scientists, and there's no real publication thing, and you've got various philosophers making philosophical conjectures about things, and one person I read recently who is Hegel, who's the the father of communism. he's the guy who Karl Marx sort of turned a few knobs and converted it to praising the Prussian state to some other things. But they used to write out theses. These philosophers would put theses on the origin of colour theory, and they'd mix good and bad, spirituality, God, and all these things, and the result is you can see the colour green, or this is such and such a colour, so complicated. And Hegel wrote a treatise saying, look, there can't be a planet between Mars and Jupiter because of these philosophical reasons. You know, like I can philosophically tell you whether it's going to be... Now, that being said, I'll just go back and say that that's a really powerful thing to do, to apply philosophy. It allows you to get in a, on an, in a direction that you haven't thought of before. So it's not completely bad, but it was allowable. And so, but it, what it turns out is that there is actually a planet between Mars and Jupiter, and that's called Ceres, C-E-R-E-S, Ceres, after the wheat, the abundant cereal. Ceres, a cereal planet. That's a little planet, and it's in the orbit there, nice and spherical, mostly iron, and very few people know about it, but it's there. This sort of says the overall story in that these people hadn't really... There was sort of a reaction against experimentalists, the doubters, the extreme doubters. They sort of believed in the human spirit and they came up with these ideas. Some of them were wacky. Some were really interesting. You know, like Kant, Immanuel Kant, did a treatise and got people really confused. And then it led to Oersted doing magnetic field measurements, which led to electromagnetism, which led to everything. You know, so these are crazy ideas, but if they're kept they're not seen as crazy. Don't do the migration from crazy into, oh, thank you very much, but it is crazy. It comes across. Look, there's just sort of countless examples of people trying to think things through, and it's sort of quite good because people didn't, you know, science, there wasn't a lot of science there. We didn't have the periodic table. We didn't have quantum mechanics, for instance. Now, we had a bit of Newton. Just another example is Leibniz. Leibniz was a, you know, all working out about the existence of God and stuff like that, and went with the really ancient philosophy of the dot, the philosophy of the dot. I'll go through a long time. And he came up with digital mathematics and binary maths as a more pure form. Just incredible. But you've got all these crazy, crazy ideas coming across. And so I just want to give the idea of these philosophers who really don't know a lot coming up with a set of crazy ideas, and they're good for a short time, and then... what's in general is that, you know, commercialism and other things have sort of left them behind. This is true of Bohr. So Bohr was at the Royal Danish Academy, or whatever it is, the Danish Institute, Science Institute, Physics Institute. And it's got a little bit of a history because it's a bit different from the Royal Society or the Academy in France or in Germany. This Danish one was basically was a beer company called Carl, and this is without a shadow of a doubt true. Like, most people would doubt that there is a microplanet between Mars and Jupiter. You have to go out and look at it, Ceres. And most people would say, oh no, this is not true. What we're teaching in school is not propaganda from a beer company. But indeed, a beer company called Karlsruhe. The names escape me. It's Karl something. Everyone will know it because it's a beer name. Karlsruhe is a. It sounds like a German town to me. Look, this is one of the deals that you get me to talk about it in a podcast, and my memory just gives away important points. And so that to set up a institute, the institute with all that beer money was, so apparently it was a very successful beer. Carl's, C-A-R-L's, something around that, it's gone from my head. And so they said, look, it's got to have royal assent. And so it got the name Royal, sort of like it was purchased, the name Royal, and they had this institute. here. And of course, Denmark had a way of just financing madcap people. So they financed Tycho Brahe and Tycho Brahe, completely madcap man. And as you read through bits of history, in general, when science expeditions go through Denmark, Denmark, I like you. You've got a Tasmanian Australian queen, so you're all okay according to us, our British things, and we love your furniture and design and stuff like that. Cheese, you know, it's Denmark Havarti, I'm not quite sure. So we think it's really, really, really great. But you read histories, and you get expeditions going through Denmark at various times, and they're as mad as cut snakes up there. Okay, he comes up with this idea, and they select him to be the head. So he's worked with a few people. I think he's a Danish person, self-funded in a way. I can't remember. He works with Rutherford, and Rutherford discovers the key starting points. Like, it sort of goes into Rutherford, and he sort of misunderstands, and I think people misunderstand Rutherford. So Rutherford discovers the nucleus. So it's a tiny little blop in the middle of an atom. And quantum physicists say, a nucleus is a tiny little blop in the middle of an atom. A quantum physicist just doesn't say, and the atom, therefore the atom is empty space, or something passes through and doesn't hit an electron. That's because it's got a different quantum, there's a whole lot of quantum mechanical stories for why that happens. So quantum mechanics is a way of thinking, and it gives you through. But he didn't do that, and he didn't pick up on quantum physics. And so he made something in line with the philosophers, as you were allowed to do back then. And he was a football player, and his brother was a bigger football player. So these people are... If you're photoshopping them, you'd say, oh, you've made a mistake. That person is too large. He's a big man. And the brother played football in the Danish Olympics. You know, real sporting family, how it goes. And he came along and gave up the Bohr picture of the atom, which happens to be easy to draw on a blackboard. And, of course, that's if you're doing a marketing thing, you want to... a slogan, I forgot what Foster's are. Australia's slogan is "Where the bloody hell are you?" and various other slogans. You call that a knife. These are very short things. He had a way of putting the atom, and a primary school teacher could teach his atom. The fact that it didn't correspond to reality was neither here nor there. And then he added to it that the electron goes in these circular orbits, and it by a miracle produces light, no mechanism behind it, when it goes from one track speeding around the atom to another track. And he says it disappears from the universe and reappears faster than the speed of light in the next track. And we don't know about this, and then this is a bit spooky. Look, you think quantum mechanics is spooky. His one is spooky. And he said, you've got a new theory? You've got something you don't understand in your theory. I'll take that across and morph it to my theory. Now, there is a little bit of an aside here, that the theory of something moving through space without... like disappearing from the universe and reappearing from the universe somewhere else. That is St. Thomas Aquinas, medieval. So you have these ancient thoughts coming out. Medieval, he had angel time. And this is things happening instantly with no space, no general relativity, nothing. And so this is sort of a consequence of doing a mashup of the Bible and Aristotle, you know, the ancient science together, they came up with angel time, and that is that you can have in the universe angels and electrons can actually disappear and reappear instantaneously across. It's called angelic time. It's not true. It's not false. You can look it up in Wikipedia and check this all up. So this is all built into here. When he used the word postulates, I postulate this, and then he basically, like, every amateur and his dog was coming into, you know, physics was coming up with a few teaser facts, and he came up with a teaser theory and came up with the idea that these electrons, for some reason, had fixed angular momentum, which is, you know, the core of quantum physics. Angular momentum is the core, but he set it there to come across. Hello. So we've got these people coming in and out of the house. This is the problem here. So he had these postulates. I think the postulates, they go in fixed orbits and break the laws of physics. So his first law of physics is that I break all the laws of physics. Whereas Einstein said, my first law of physics is that all laws of physics apply all the time. He said, they don't apply at all. It's like correspondence. And then he said that they radiate light when it moves from one orbit to the other. It's sort of like the part of your essay, you're late at night and you say, I woke up, it was all a dream, this topic. So this is rubbish beyond all rubbish. Then he has calculations of angular momentum, this thing, and it gives the lines, but it only explains one atom. So his theory only explains a hydrogen atom. It doesn't explain anything else. So it's an outright failure. But this is the theory of the atom taught to our kids. You could say right or wrong. But along with it is a sort of basic sort of, hocus pocus going in with it. A whole lot of avenue for people. There's a whole... Yeah, what I really disliked is the power, imbalance of power in that Copenhagen school, and the way that when someone said, tried to say something, tried to bully them if they said they didn't understand it. And so you either in or out of him. So, come World War II. Well, there's two stories for Bohr's Nobel Prize, and there's one which obviously happens in that he said he hocked the Nobel Prize, took it down to the pawn shop, whatever it is, I'm not sure, but he gave it to fund the war in Finland against the Russians. So the Russians began invading Finland. It was all, you know, World War II. Go figure. You know, there's so much happening, so many moving parts and stuff like that. And he was with a Jewish group. And then the Nazis came along and went to Denmark. I know they took 24 hours to take Denmark. Sort of like stuff. So it took Denmark in no time whatsoever. The royal family, the Danish royal family, fled to Britain. And eventually Bohr... because it was getting a bit hot with the Nazis. Now, this is the second story with Bohr, is that he, with the Nazis coming, dissolved his Nobel Prize. So one, he sold it. The other story is that he dissolved it in acid and turned it, his Nobel Prize, into atoms and then undissolved his Nobel Prize. Precipitated his Nobel Prize afterwards at gold. When you hear these stories, read these stories, you go, oh, well, one of them doesn't add up, but, and you think in your head, well, I'm not going to speak with anybody else in my short lifetime about this, so... I'll just reserve you know, just let it roll in. So this is a story of the Nazis coming in and war at the last moment, throwing his Nobel Prize and saying, "That is the Nobel Prize." Can you imagine that type of stuff? I don't know. And there it is, dissolving in a beaker above him and stuff like that. And then, so the major thing is that he our atom person, went to Sweden with his family, but he himself was evacuated from Sweden by a mosquito bomber, and they had a thing that he was going to be put in the bomb bay, but not in a way strapped in such that he could be dropped, right? And he had a helmet, but his head was too big for the helmet, so he nearly asphyxiated and died as they flew over, and the mosquito bomber flew very low, and they had the thing that if the mosquito bomber was going to be attacked by German aircraft, that it was to drop bore. Now, they were going to drop bore as a bore bomb to drop it. So he survived barely. Now, you're sort of starting off on a wrong foot with this classical stuff, the school stuff. Then the war didn't stop there. In 1936, I suppose, this is before World War II, he came up with the liquid drop model. So there's a whole series of models. Basically, any page you like to look in a high school syllabus goes back to someone who was wrong, and they even withdraw their own paper. So the leading up to the Bohr model was the Drude model, of the electron, which is the electrons as tiny little buzzy flies which go through a lattice of nuclei. So the pre-1901 Drude model. Completely incorrect, and Drude withdrew it that year as stupid. But it doesn't stop us selling it. That's the main one. You get points in your HSC. If you can memorize that, you can come top of the state by memorizing. This is the Drude model. Remember, that's incorrect. Then Bohr came up with the liquid drop model. Now, the liquid drop model, so he came up with the orbiting electrons, and that was disproven and junked by modern science. 26, 23, basically the rest of the world went on with it. So after that, 1936, he had the liquid drop model, which liquid drop model is that little circle of the nucleus with the little protons and neutrons as little circles, because the proton and neutron is definitely the quantum mechanics. I haven't understood quantum mechanics, so I can't have a neutron slide through another neutron, which it does do. Neutrons, they slide through each other, and all the particles slide through each other, and the neutron sits inside the electron. The electron actually permeates the neutron and the protons and stuff like that. This is what actually happens. Bohr couldn't understand that, so he came up with the liquid drop model, which in 1936, I think it lasted a couple of months before it was junked, and we've got a much better model. But that's the model that we teach all our kids now, and we pay a lot of government money to educators to go around. All right, see you. Thanks a lot. Okay. This is what you're getting. That model is incorrect, and there's a number of reasons that you can pretty quickly tell it's incorrect. But it's all sort of courtesy going along. And then finally, you've got, the electron doing a little bit what Bohr said about coming into existence and out of existence, and a bit of the Bohr, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And that's called the Born interpretation. It's all called the Copenhagen School. So the Copenhagen School, the Copenhagen School is complete
wallop.
But it says the wave function is a mathematical description of where the particle electron can exist, comes into existence and disappears. So it doesn't come into existence and drop between orbitals. It comes into existence and disappears between points in the wave. It's just complete and utter garbage. And there's a little bit of a story, a little bit of corruption going on in that Max Born, who's from the Copenhagen School, something along that, organised a book to be written in which he got Schrodinger to write a chapter, but didn't show Schrodinger the entire book. And Schrodinger's chapters was in there, and then his chapters, which Schrodinger hated, was in there. And Schrodinger just thought it was complete and utter rubbish. Now, we've got this thing about, well, look, you scientists, how come you aren't fighting amongst yourself and actually organising this now? I'm just trying to think, it's sort of like, people do a lot of stupid things, like, I suppose, look, I have to say, eating Kentucky Fried Chicken for me is a stupid thing to do because it's all fatty and awful and it's just not worth money. It's just so awful. But I don't go around sort of putting big X's on Colonel Sanders and, you know, at parties people say, oh, well, what gives you goats? And I don't suddenly say, oh, I hate Colonel Sanders and stuff like that. So also at parties, people are saying, oh, my son did very well in the HSC exam. Oh, he answered all these questions, blah, blah, blah. And, oh, I know all of this. And you don't go, oh, well, it's, you know, how to lose friends and not influence anyone is to go against this bore thing. However, you're going to have to do it. It's one of these horrible journeys. You don't have to tell everyone that you're beginning to understand quantum mechanics. You can just, we understand this much, that the social model of mass education is not working for quantum mechanics. And so for you to understand those four things and really get into the wave functions, it's best to actually go back and actually, start to understand quantum mechanics, and it's not a recipe to understand why someone gave you the wrong explanation is not the thing. So if someone's lost in the bush and there's a whole lot of, you know, the Australian bush, so Australia, huge, vast, open spaces. Occasionally, tourists think they know a lot, take a map, walk out, they get lost. Okay, that's the scenario. And we've got to find it. And if you see that there's a group which is getting a lot of people together and they're not that competent and that type of stuff, you don't spend your time trying to correct them. You just leave them alone and get on with things. So the next episode, I might talk about computers and solar cells, and talk a little bit about, you know, electrons I have known well. Some of my favourite electrons I'll talk about in the next one. Thanks a lot for listening, and I hope this does the thing. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.